Hi, hello, and welcome to Beyond Reproach.
Hey, guys.
This is the podcast where we talk about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Yes.
I'm Tux Lerzel.
I'm Stephanie Domingo.
And we are drankin'.
Sure are.
It's cheers.
Ooh, yes. Cheers.
Cheers.
Salute.
When I was a kid at school, learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
I'm gonna say something and I don't want you to be offended.
Say it.
Kind of tastes like a boozy squirt.
No, that's
right?
Yeah, I love that.
Because it has.
There's no grapefruit though, but.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Are you thinking of like
Pellegrino?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
A lemon.
Yeah, it does taste like the lemon,
right?
Pellegrino. Yes,
yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Okay.
Today we are drinking gin punch.
Oh, gin, it's so good.
Gin punch came out in the like 1820s, 1830s. There's a lot of recipes online that if you Google gin punch, there's a million recipes, and I have some old, like 1800s cocktail books that have recipes, and there's so many different versions of it. But the one that we're drinking today is sort of my adaptation of a Victorian era recipe that the New York Times shared. Their recipe is in punch format, so it's like a punch bowl.
Yeah.
I sort of reformatted it to be more of a single serving cocktail just for us. And you can find the recipe on our website, beyondreproachpod.com.
Why didn't you make us a big bowl of punch?
That's true. I should have. It's pretty similar to a Tom Collins, if any of you have had a Tom Collins, which is gin, lemon juice, sugar, and seltzer water. But this also has lemon peel and orange liqueur in it. And I didn't realize when I first saw it, I was like, this says that it's a historic recipe, but it has seltzer. That can't be right. I didn't
think. Oh, yeah.
But I actually did some research, and seltzer was invented in 1767.
What?
I had no idea.
Wow. Yeah. I thought it was such a modern.
Yeah, me too.
Like, maybe, like, at the earliest, I'm like 1910.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. When I saw that the recipe had seltzer, I was like, that's not old.
Yeah.
But, it, yeah, it
Damn.
Is.
Okay.
Side note, so since I mentioned the Tom Collins, which is the cocktail Tom Collins got its name in the stupidest, most hilarious way. In the, like, 1800s, there was this weird joke going around where people would approach people on, like, the street and be like, hey, have you seen Tom Collins? And the person would be like, who the fuck is
Tom
Collins?
Tom Collins? Yeah.
And so the other person would be like, oh, well, you better find them because they're talking like mad shit about you and you better go figure it out. Tom Collins is like a dick and you better find out what's going on.
Okay.
It was so weird. And so then a bar decided to name a cocktail a Tom Collins so that if somebody came into the bar looking for Tom Collins,
oh,
they would make them the drink and be like, here's the drink you
that
ordered.
That is marketing. Yeah. Well, that's so funny and
yeah.
So smart.
But also the dumbest joke.
It's stupid.
It's really dumb.
But they didn't have Netflix and like things to occupy themselves
yeah.
with. So they're making their own fun.
Yeah.
And their fun's real lame, but
yeah, that's
you know.
True. Good for them.
We got a drink out of it.
So the reason we're drinking this cocktail from like the 1820s-ish is that Stephanie is going to go first today, and her scandal is, what era would you say?
My scandal is the 1830s.
Okay.
1820s through 1830s.
Yeah. It's hard to find these like really old cocktail recipes. There's not a lot to choose from. If you get anything before like the 1850s, it's like slim pickings trying to find something. And like, I can't just make a sherry cobbler for every other episode.
Yeah. Even though that would be delicious.
Yes.
That was so, so good. So my scandal is the Trail of Tears. This is going to be the first of probably at least three scandals on this topic. I'm going to gloss over. It's big. And three, I don't even know if I could put it into three to really talk about all the people that I want to talk about, because everyone is scandalous in their own right.
Yeah.
When you start looking into any of the players in this. So this is going to be a foundation today.
I think that's a good way to do it. It needs
yeah.
to. It's definitely so much.
It's
there's so
much
that you can't do it all in one episode.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing how you handle this, because there are other topics that I would like to discuss in the future, but I'm having a hard time deciding how to approach a topic that's that deep.
Yes. And do it justice.
Yeah, do it justice.
And not gloss over it.
But and also not have the episode so it'd be 6 hours long.
Yes, exactly. Hopefully this goes okay.
Yeah.
this will be the test.
You're setting a precedent.
Yeah. Oh God. So I'm going to be rotating terminology, like native terminology. I'm going to use indigenous, I'm going to use Indian, I'm going to use American Indian, Native American, because these are terms that they all do use secondary to their tribal affiliation. So I'm just going to be switching them up. I hope everyone knows about the Trail of Tears, at least generally, right?
As long if they're American.
Yeah.
We do have some listeners, some, I almost said out of town, some out of town listeners, some
international.
Overseas. Yes, there we go.
Yes.
Listeners who might not be fully aware of the Trail of Tears, but anyone who was educated in the United States should at least have a very rough idea of what this is.
I learned it so abbreviated.
Yes.
That when I started to look into it, I'm just like, oh my God.
Well, if you guys listen to the minisode, we talk about slavery, and there were lots of people who wrote in also on the subject of indigenous people. So I'm glad that we're talking about this because it is so relevant to discussions about race and things that are going on in this country right now. So
it felt like it was something that I had to do. Like, this has been something that I wanted to talk about since we started.
Yeah.
And I've just been working on this outline since we started, basically.
Wow,
but I'm just like, this is too much. The story is
so
too
much,
big.
Yeah.
But now I have it in a way that I can break it into three, I think, pretty.
Yeah.
Okay. So generally, the Trail of Tears refers to the death march during the 1830s of the five tribes of Native Indians from their ancestral homes in the southeast to west of the Mississippi. So they were moved from their homes where they had been for almost a millennium.
To make room for fucking strip malls.
Yes. The five tribes were the Cherokee, the Creek, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, and the Seminole. And approximately 100,000 indigenous people were forced to leave their homes during that period. The Trail of Tears is meant to evoke the collective suffering experienced, but it's most generally used to talk about the removal experiences of Indians in the Southeast. But the Cherokee specifically.
Mm-hmm.
The physical trail consisted of several land routes and one main water route that stretched over 5,000 miles and across 9 states. As we all know, as I hope we all know, removal actions, some of which were, I don't know, I hate saying this, but it kept coming up in my research. Some of these removal actions were voluntary. I'm like, I think they moved because they didn't want to die.
Yeah, you're given a choice.
Yeah.
Here's the choice.
Yeah, let's maybe say reluctantly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But everywhere I went, it said voluntary. I'm like, this is not true.
Yes. It's not like they were like, hey, you know what I look to do today?
I kept reading that. I'm like, I will say it, but I will say it with a caveat because I think that this is a lie.
Yeah.
Most of which was done forcibly. Eventually, this occurred to all American Indian groups, regardless of where they were in the country. So basically, anywhere indigenous people were, their presence was a problem. The roots of forced relocation lay in greed, obviously.
Uh-huh.
The British proclaimed in 1763 that the land between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River was dedicated Indian territory, although that region was to be protected for the exclusive use of indigenous people. Large numbers of Euro-American land speculators and settlers soon moved into that region. For the most part, the British and later the U.S. government ignored all of these acts of trespass on sovereign native land by non-indigenous people. There had been conflicts between whites and natives since the first settlers arrived in North America, but in the early 1800s, the issue had come down to white settlers encroaching on fertile Indian lands in the South. The population was booming down there. This was post-cotton gin production time, so they're on super fertile lands, and the five Indian tribes were located on land primarily used for cotton cultivation.
Okay.
Natives themselves had been enslaved, and before and after kidnapped Africans arrived, there was a period of overlap for about approximately 150 years that they were enslaved in tandem. It wasn't until the mid-18th century that the bondage of American Indians went down due to the arrival of the greater frequency of Africans coming over.
Okay.
As that sort of kicked up, that's when Native American enslavement went down. Over time, white colonists viewed Africans as mindless beasts of burden and they saw the indigenous as something more, quote, noble. They were noble savages, air quotes.
Mm-hmm. And they were still in our way.
Yeah. Unrefined, but courageous and fierce. Perversely, the ownership of enslaved Africans came about as a way for natives to illustrate their societal sophistication to whites. Over time, the tribes in the South tended to adopt white ways, such as taking up farming, and in some cases, even buying and owning African slaves. So these efforts at assimilation led to the tribes being known as the, quote, five civilized tribes.
Oh, yeah. Wow, lucky them.
Yeah, we don't use that word anymore because it's, you know, Eurocentric garbage.
Sure. Yeah,
but yeah, that's what they called them at the time, the five civilized tribes. According to historian Tia Miles, they were, quote, working hard to comply with government dictates that told Native people that in order to be protected and secure in their land base, they had to prove their level of, quote, civilization. In capitalism-crazed America, enslaved people became tokens of economic success. The more people you owned, the more serious of a business person you were. The more serious of a business person you were, the fitter you were to join the ranks of civilized, end quote, society. So enslaved people at the time were a status symbol for both whites and Indians.
Yeah. I feel like I'm just going to be like huffing and puffing and shaking my head throughout this entire, like, I don't even know what to say.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, none of this lessens the horrors, the genocide that happened to, you know, native people, to the Cherokee. In the 1820s and in the 1830s, Georgia conducted a relentless campaign to remove the Cherokees who had held territory within their borders. In 1827, the Cherokee Nation established a constitutional government. The Cherokees were not only restructuring their government, but also declaring to the American public that they were a sovereign nation that could not be removed without their consent. So an infuriated Georgia legislature responded by claiming to extend its jurisdiction over the Cherokees living in their state's boundaries. And in 1829, 2 years later, the worst thing that could happen happened. A gold rush happened in Georgia.
Jesus.
Yes. At its peak, Georgia mines produced approximately 300 ounces of gold a day. Land speculators soon demanded that the U.S. Congress devolve to the states the control of all property owned by the tribes and its members. A year later, Congress complied by passing the Indian Removal Act of 1830. The act entitled the president to negotiate with the Eastern nations to facilitate their removal to tracts of land west of the Mississippi and provided some $500,000 for transportation and for compensation to Native landowners. Yes, that position was supported by the president at the time, Andrew Jackson. I don't know if you know anything about Andrew Jackson. He's a peach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a reason why he sits over Trump's desk.
Yeah.
They're very similar. So he himself was an avid speculator, and he was a notorious hater of Indians. The mineral-rich land full of gold would be property of the state of Georgia to dole out to white landowners. So in short, it kind of authorized the government to rip up indigenous land deeds and like throw them into the fire, basically.
Nice.
Andrew Jackson's support for the removal of natives began at least a decade before his presidency because he was the federal Indian commissioner. So Indian removal was top of mind. It was his first, it was his only real legislative mandate. He talked about it in his inaugural address.
Wow.
He said that Indian emigration, quote, should be voluntary, for it would be cruel as unjust to compel the Aborigines to abandon the graves of their fathers and seek a home in a distant land. On the other hand, he made it clear that Indians could not live as independent peoples within the United States. He said, quote, surrounded by whites with their arts of civilization, they would be doomed to weakness and decay.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Also, is so Aborigine
like talking
like a,
out of, well, that's what they said back then.
Yeah.
I mean, they said a whole bunch of things that weren't. Yeah.
Well, sure. Not kosher, for sure. Yeah.
The removals conducted under both President Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren followed the Indian Removal Act, provided the president with the powers to exchange land with native tribes and provide infrastructure improvements on the existing lands. The law also gave the president power to pay for transportation costs to the West should tribes choose to relocate. The law did not, however, allow the president to force tribes to move west without a mutually agreed upon treaty.
Mutually agreed upon. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, we will find out.
Yeah.
So Jackson, he reiterated, he just had such a hard on for Indians. It's really, there's so
like
much.
Like a hate hard on?
Yes. Yes. A hateful hard on is what he had for the original people of this land. He reiterated his support in various messages to Congress. In these speeches, he talked about his political justifications for removal and described some of the outcomes he expected would derive from the relocation process. He was trying to spin it as a win-win.
They really lucked out.
Yeah.
We did them a huge favor by stealing all their land and killing half of them. Well, more than half of them.
Yeah. He suggested that indigenous people would be smart to give up their protected ancestral lands.
Smart. If they didn't want to fucking die and get run over by
these lands that were rich in gold deposits and soil for farming to the whites in exchange for, quote, separating them from immediate contact with white settlement, free them from the power of the states, enable them to pursue happiness in their own way under their own rude institutions. End quote.
Oh my fucking Christ.
Can you believe this bitch? I'm going to drop my favorite of his speeches on natives. This one's really short, but it's crazy.
Yeah.
His words are insane. This garbage man goes on to say, quote, "It is supposed that the wandering savage has a stronger attachment to his home than the settled, civilized Christian. Is it more afflicting to him to leave the graves of his fathers than for our brothers and children? Rightly considered, the policy of the general government towards the red man is not only liberal, but generous. He is unwilling to submit to the laws of the states and mingle with their population to save him from this alternative or perhaps utter annihilation. The general government kindly offers him a new home and proposes to pay the whole expense of his removal and resettlement." End quote. Here
what
you go.
What a mensch.
Yeah. So people at the time, they knew it was wrong. They knew that it was illegal. They knew that it was unconstitutional. And it happened anyways. The U.S. shouldn't have removed the Cherokee Nation. It shouldn't have moved any of these nations from their land. Because they were a group of people, a unified people, who had chosen to live together for almost a millennia. Like a millennia. We don't even have a concept of what that means because this country is so new.
Yeah.
Even if Columbus was a real thing and he actually put a foot on North American soil, this country would be 526 years old. And that's a goddamn lie.
Yeah.
But if we start with the declarations, 242 years. So 2 centuries, not even 2.5 centuries.
Absolutely unbelievable.
So it's brand new. It's crazy. So the Cherokee, they organize themselves around a sophisticated common law with a capital, with recognized regions. All 7 family clans were represented in every town. Unlike many other Indian tribes who rebelled against the new order, the Cherokee decided to join it. They signed treaties and accepted the protection of the federal government. This was a people who wanted to live together, who had a shared history, a shared culture. They were open. I mean, they weren't happy about the changes, but they were open to trying to live in a framework in this new America.
Sure. There's a touch of that in my next story.
Oh, okay.
Just a civilization that realizes that if they don't accept change and go forward, they're going to cease to exist.
Yes.
So it's
survival.
Forward thinking of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though it's still horrific.
Yeah. It's crazy, but they were adapting to a new environment out of their will to survive and not be completely exterminated.
What a horrible position to be in.
It's unfathomable, really.
Yeah.
It's terrible. They were open to this changing environment, and still they were death marched. Now the Cherokees are found all over the country, mostly in Oklahoma, which is where they were resettled, but they're also found in Mexico. So they completely broke up a unified nation into smaller parts. They're no longer the coherent group that they had been previously. Obviously, it was morally wrong, but, you know, when has this country ever been about the moral right, really?
Yeah.
It's morally wrong if we consider the loss of life that took place. The official report suggests that roughly 4,000 people died, but we know that many people died in these containment centers, that they were placed before they were death marched. Today's scholars believe that the number is probably conservative. They suspect somewhere between a quarter and a third of the Cherokee Nation was lost during the Trail of Tears, so maybe upwards of 8,000 people. And this is just the Cherokee.
Yeah.
Because there were five tribes, but then there's so many different other nations that were also death marched. So I'm specifically talking about the Cherokee.
Yeah.
Of those who were lost, those were the ones who were least likely to endure starvation and exposure to the elements. These are people who are being marched like 10 plus miles a day in knee-deep snow with no shoes, no moccasins often. So it was really the elderly and the infants that died mostly.
Mm-hmm.
They would arrive in Oklahoma without their past and future.
Yeah.
Most of the death during the journey were caused by disease, malnutrition, and exposure because they were marched during an unusually cold winter. In the winter of 1838, the Cherokee began their 1,000-mile death march. Wearing scant clothing, the march began in Red Clay, Tennessee, the location of the last eastern capital in the Cherokee Nation. Because of the diseases that were afflicting the Indians, they weren't allowed to go into cities or towns because they were afraid of they would spread, infect the whites.
Mm-hmm.
So they were marched around cities and towns. So it just made it so much farther for them to go. After crossing Tennessee and Kentucky, they arrived at the Ohio River, crossed from Golconda in southern Illinois around December 3rd. Here, the starving Indians were charged $1 a head, equal to $23, to cross a river by the ferry. Yeah. So they were just extorted along the way, basically.
Didn't they say that they would pay for this?
They would pay, but they would pay out of the money. They got like $500,000 to go by the government, and the government was paying like per head.
So they paid them in advance, and then like along the way they were like, oh, but this, you have to pay us for...
They paid for the organization.
Sure.
And then along the way they would, I guess, use that money. So they were just being extorted like every time there was a river crossing, mm-hmm. basically. Like the town was like, okay, give me this much. This one crossing was really, really bad because typically people were charged 12 cents. And they were charged $1. And the 12 cents would have been like $2.76 today. And they weren't allowed passage until the ferry had serviced all other people willing to cross. So all like the whites could go through. So they were forced to take shelter under this mantle rock. I guess it's like a bluff on the Kentucky side. Until, quote, Barry had nothing better to do. So many died huddled together at Mantle Rock waiting to cross. And several Cherokee were murdered by the locals because they were just there forever because this guy was just like, eh, whatever, they can wait. Even the whites were like, this is insane.
Yeah.
This is inhumane. Like, I can't believe you're doing this to these people, like women and children, elderly, and it's so cold. So I have a eyewitness account on December 26th, Martin Davis, who's a commissary agent. He wrote, there is the coldest winter in Illinois I've ever experienced anywhere. The streams are all frozen over something like 8 to 12 inches thick. We are compelled to cut through the ice to get water for ourselves and animals. It snows here every 2 or 3 days at the farthest. We are now camped in Mississippi River Swamp, 4 miles from the river, and there is no possible chance of crossing the river for the numerous quantity of ice that comes floating down the river every day. So they're... they're walking into this river. We've only traveled 65 miles on the last month, including the time spent at this place, which has been about 3 weeks. It's unknown when we shall cross the river. In December. December 26th.
This is insane.
Yeah.
This is...
Yeah, it's horrendous. It's, like, so depressing. It's why I really didn't want to do this story, but I had to do this story.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
it's just... I think we do ourselves such a disservice not to talk about this head on. It's our history. This happened.
Yeah.
It's documented. We know. I took another eyewitness, a soldier from Georgia who participated in the removal said, quote, I fought through the war between the states and I've seen many men shot, but the Cherokee removal was the cruelest work I've ever known. So it eventually took almost 3 months to cross the 60 miles on land between Ohio and Mississippi rivers. The trek through the southern part of Illinois is where the Cherokee suffered most of their deaths. However, a few years before forced removal, some of the Cherokee opted to leave their homes, voluntarily, reluctantly.
Yeah.
They chose a water route through Tennessee, Ohio, and Mississippi rivers, and it only took 21 days. But the Cherokee who were forcefully relocated were wary of water travel. These are the ones who had to death march. So the bulk of the Cherokee Nation arrived in Indian Territory, like I said, without its past and without its future. An unknown thousand of the Cherokees enslaved, mixed race and African people also died on the road to their masters' new homes. They were forced to work while they death marched. So they hunted, they chopped wood, they nursed the sick, they washed clothes, they prepared meals, they guarded the camps at night, and they hiked ahead to remove obstructions from the roads. The main arguments used to justify the Trail of Tears was a bald-faced lie. It was the idea that the Cherokee could not adapt to the new world, that they would be uncomfortable in this environment in the United States. But the fact is, by the 1830s, the Cherokees had a written language. They had a written and ratified constitution. They had a bilingual press and newspaper. They had institutions of higher learning for both men and women. Some scholars even suggest that they had a higher literacy rate than the surrounding southern states at the time. So to say that the Cherokee could not adapt, could not assimilate to the culture is a lie, completely ridiculous. According to Paul Chat Smith, he's the museum curator for the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, the Cherokee were, quote, deeply committed to slavery, established their own racialized laws, immediately reestablished slavery when they arrived in Indian Territory, rebuilt their nations with slave labor, crushed slave rebellions, and they enthusiastically sided with the Confederacy during the war. So they were definitely able to adapt to the American framework. They were angry with the white encroachment on their land, but they were willing to be a part of this new world. But be that as it may, it shouldn't have happened. More than a moral thing, it's just fact. I'm just going to discuss two of the main reasons in this episode because, again, this story is so big. Constitutionally, it should have never happened because when it became clear that Americans who favored Indian removal were not okay waiting until the Cherokee were willing to sell their property, because obviously the Cherokee didn't want to go anywhere, because why should they? They turned to the state of Georgia to press the issue, to force the issue. And Georgians were more than happy to kind of write the Cherokee out of existence. Mm-hmm. The Georgia state legislature tried to dissolve their sovereignty. They didn't recognize its borders or its laws or its constitution. They wanted to take their property and give it to Georgia citizens. And they weren't even pretending to want to do that. One of the means they tried using was to suggest that anyone who wasn't a Cherokee who lived amongst the Cherokee had to get permission from the state of Georgia to do so. And there were a number of people who were not interested in doing this. Some of them were white missionaries who had lived and worked with the Cherokees, who were there by Cherokee in invitation and consent. Mm-hmm. For example, there was a man by the name of Samuel Worcester, who was a committed missionary who worked with the Cherokee press, translating documents and such, hymns, scripture. He said, quote, "We don't have to get permission from anyone other than the Cherokee to live amongst the Cherokee."
Yeah.
I mean, I think they just wanted the whites out so they could just, like, kill everyone.
Yeah, and they didn't want witnesses.
Exactly. Jesus. Yeah. They didn't want witnesses. They, especially witnesses who work for the press.
Yeah.
So the state of Georgia, they pressed the issue and they started arresting missionaries and they sentenced them to hard labor.
What the
fuck? Yeah, for, quote unquote, acting outside of Georgia law. So once missionaries were imprisoned, it laid the foundation for a Supreme Court challenge to Georgia law. Because like I said, the Cherokee, they were willing to work within the laws of this country.
Yeah.
So they're just like, oh, you're doing something that's illegal. Let me take this to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1832, the Cherokee Nation pressed forward with their case, Worcester, the missionary, against the state of Georgia.
Good.
What do you think happened? What do you think the Supreme Court said?
Well, I want to say they wouldn't even hear the case, but
No, they heard the case.
Okay, but obviously they sided with the U.S. government.
No, they sided with the Indians.
Really?
Yes. So the Supreme Court agreed with the Cherokees. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall, decided that, in fact, Georgia, like every other state in the nation, had to recognize the sovereignty of the Cherokee, and that the relationship was not between the Cherokee and the state of Georgia. It was between the Cherokee and the state of the United States.
Yeah, holy shit.
Between them and our national government. So the Georgia law was declared unconstitutional.
And then what?
Well, winning their argument should have ended the clash with the state of Georgia.
And
but
yet?
President Jackson, he refused to execute the decision. He ignored the judiciary. And mm-hmm. yeah.
And this is why Trump loves him so much.
Yeah. So this was the first failure of our check and balance system.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, even though the Cherokee won their case, they lost because Andrew Jackson refused to recognize the legitimacy of the courts, the highest court in the land.
That's so fucking crazy.
Yeah. Who knew that could happen? When I read this, I'm like, what?
You can't just do this? You can't just decide that you don't. Oh my God.
Yeah. It can happen again, you guys.
Old Hickory. That's Jackson, right?
When you said hickory, I thought of like those smoked sausages. Delicious. The opposite of Jackson. So there's another way in which this shouldn't have happened legally, and that is the Treaty of New Echota in 1835, which was used to justify the physical act of removing the Cherokee Nation. This treaty was completely invalid, and everyone knew it. What happened was a small group of Cherokees, they suspected was like less than 30 people, became convinced that the situation was coming to a head and the choice was between the Cherokee property and Cherokee lives. They thought that if they remained in their homeland, which obviously everyone wanted to do, that they would be eradicated. And the only way they thought to survive was to leave. So they pursued a treaty with the U.S. government, even though none of them held elected office. They exchanged all their land east of the Mississippi for land west in modern Oklahoma in exchange for a $5 million payment from the federal government. None of them were legitimate representatives of the Cherokee Nation, and it's kind of one of the sad ironies that two of the people in this group had been instrumental in shaping the Cherokee Constitution that made it a capital offense to do exactly what they were doing.
Holy shit.
Which was to misrepresent the will of the Cherokee people and make a decision to cede Cherokee land. But they did it anyways, even knowing that they were committing suicide basically by signing this treaty. But they believed it was the only way to save the nation and that they would survive as a whole. So what happens next is what you would expect would happen immediately after this bogus treaty was signed by these, like, 20 dudes, the re-elected leaders of the Cherokee Nation. They stood up and said that obviously this doesn't...
You can't do that.
You can't do this. This doesn't represent the will of our people.
Yeah.
This is completely illegitimate. Like, who are you guys? You can't ratify a treaty if it's just like a handful of dodgy private citizens. So the principal chief of the Cherokees, John Ross, was determined to fight this at every level. Once it was signed, he tried to speak to then President Martin Van Buren, but without success. He tried to speak to the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, didn't have any success there. He put together a petition with over 15,000 signatures of the Cherokee citizens, took it to the Senate to show that the vast majority of the Cherokee Nation was in an outcry. They couldn't believe that they could be forcefully removed on the basis of something that was clearly illegitimate. But by the time the Senate reconvened, he didn't really have an opportunity to present all these signatures because the death march was imminent, basically. Yeah. So that's kind of the end of my, like, sort of foundational part of this. There are lessons, I think, that are really important to talk about with this story. It shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have happened at all.
Yeah.
The U.S. moved forward with actions that were unconstitutional, like it's documented, and then they did something that was illegal. The treaty was illegal. Not just physical lands were taken, but homes and businesses, farms and improvements, because of this this death march, Cherokees were only allowed to take what they could carry on their backs and nothing more. So in a way, the Trail of Tears is also a massive like redistribution scheme, yeah, in which people who had no legal recourse, a minority that couldn't defend themselves legally, they went all the way. I mean, they tried. They did everything they were supposed to do. And they won their Supreme Court case, but still they didn't have the might of the state guns behind them. They didn't have the president's support. So they lost everything they had.
It tells a little bit of a story about how the government will ignore, we will ignore our own laws if they're inconvenient for, yeah, what we're trying to do. And, yeah, and we're experiencing this a little bit right now, but this is also not like Jackson and Trump are not the only presidents who have done this.
No.
And
no.
If you think about Japanese internment,
yeah,
and there's so many other,
yeah,
other chapters in our history that we can, it is blatantly ignoring the laws of our own country.
Oh, yes. The laws that we wrote, the laws that we claim to cherish more than anything. It was a precedent setting move.
Yeah.
Like this has, yeah, never happened before. It's happened since, but it was in a different way with Lincoln. He sort of, I think he stopped habeas corpus during the Civil War. But yeah, this is the first time that the executive branch willingly disobeyed the judiciary. That's, that has the final say in the rule of law. They're just like, nah.
These people have these protections under our laws.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're just like, yeah, but
yeah,
we don't want to.
Yeah. The treaties were invalid and they were ratified nonetheless. And this will be a huge theme in all Native American issues. It's like, it's so clear what they're doing. It's not even clever. This is genocide. This,
yeah,
is definitely 100%. Genocide.
It is, yeah.
We need to get more comfortable.
State sanctioned.
Yeah. Calling things by their names. The resources that I was pulling from on the internet, all of them were just like forced relocation. I'm like, oh, you mean a death march?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
A death march.
Call it what it is.
Yeah. We need to be more comfortable by calling things by their proper name. None of these people move voluntarily. I don't care what the internet says.
Even the ones that say that
it's
was voluntary.
It's a goddamn lie. Like, they wanted to live.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
they moved. The death march was gunpoint. Like they were moving. But yeah, none of this was voluntary. And that's a lie that is everywhere on the internet. And this is the foundation of our country. And I don't think we really have that national conscious about it. I mean, we talk about Native people around, as my sister said, like between Columbus Day and Thanksgiving.
The way we discuss Columbus and the way our country glorifies Columbus is asinine.
Shameful.
Shameful. Yeah. 100%.
It's shameful.
But he's just a small fraction of,
yeah,
the horrors that, yeah, our government has.
Yeah.
I'm like out of words. Normally I'm so verbose, but like I don't even know what to say.
Yeah.
It's hard to be humorous when the subject is genocide.
It's true.
You know?
Yeah, it's tough.
So that was your sort of introduction to the,
yeah,
topic.
Yeah, this is my introduction, and I gloss over so much.
Yeah.
Like, oh, so much.
And then in the future, you'll do...
Yeah, I'm going to go into people.
Okay, specific, yeah, people and specific
people.
Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to come back to it at a later date, at least two more times, because I just have a lot more that I'd like, yeah, to say. The story is not what we learned in schools,
yeah,
like at all.
100%.
It's not black or white. Like, I didn't know that the Cherokee had enslaved people. Like, I didn't know that it was like a status thing. Like, you were aspiring to own people as natives.
That from on the internet, it, mm-hmm, tends to be coming from trolls who use, like, Aryan white supremacist,
oh,
trolls,
okay,
love to use that fact as a justification for white slave owners. Like,
but
oh,
they were,
it wasn't
mimicking
just white, people.
White slave owners.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's the culture.
But,
yeah,
they love to,
oh,
use,
course,
that as a way to justify and be,
yeah,
like, well, white people aren't the worst because Native people did that,
we're
too.
We're not saying that they're the worst. We're saying this is just what happened.
It's,
yeah.
Yeah. We're not, yeah, trying to like single anyone out.
Yeah,
but, like,
no.
The majority
this
of
is
slave
the history.
Owners were white people. So.
Oh, yes. The vast majority.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not the point, but just
white,
like,
people.
I need a moment after,
yeah,
that. That was,
I'm going to drink my drink now,
yeah,
that I'm done.
Suck that shit down because, yeah, I need a minute. minute before we go into my next story. I will say my next story is lighter.
It's around this. Oh, lighter. Okay, good.
Yes, it's much lighter.
I mean, it's hard not to be lighter than Jennifer. So yeah, let's just say that.
I'm just talking about serial killers.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Yeah, no.
I made it light and fun, right? Tux is like, I feel dead inside.
Yeah. I'm sorry I was so quiet in that episode. I what can you say? You know, what do you...
Yeah, it's a lot.
So my story is a little bit lighter. Much lighter. So there's two things that Stephanie loves to talk about.
Hamilton?
No, about me.
Oh, okay.
There's two things about me that Stephanie loves to bring up, but I talk about them too. So the first of them is that I am approximately 1,000 years
yes,
old.
Yes, yes.
I love all the same things that old people love. Yeah. I love butter pecan ice cream.
Yeah, of course you do.
Love butter pecan
ice cream. Ew!
I love...
You are so old! Wow! I love that I know how old you are, but still I'm just like, butter pecan?
Yep. Maple walnut, send it my way. I love shaking my fist at the kids in my lawn.
I feel like you aspire to have dentures, like, now.
And most importantly, I'm obsessed with old movies. I love, like, black and white movies. My favorite era is movies from the 40s. Seriously, I would rather watch a movie from, like, 1942 than something that was from 2018. Any day of the week, I would rather watch. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know this. I know this.
The second thing that we like to talk about is that I do not, as much as I love old movies, I do not really care for musical theater.
For shame.
These two things, this combination of things about me brought me to my scandal today. I love to watch TCM, the Turner Classic Movies, the old movie channel on cable.
Oh, God.
I literally will sit here and go through the guide on the cable and just DVR like anything I haven't seen before.
Wow.
Even if it doesn't even look that good, I'll still DVR it and then I'll give
it.
Can you
watch it all?
Like, if it's bad, I will watch like the first 10 minutes and see.
Okay.
But if I haven't seen it, I'm like, okay, I can.
Wow.
The one thing I don't love about these movies is there's a lot of culture that is problematic today.
Oh, duh.
So the way people of color are portrayed and the way the language that's used sometimes. Anyway, I'm looking for specific, especially movies from the 40s. And a movie from 1946 comes on. It's called Anna and the King of Siam.
Yeah, I've seen the musical.
Well, so this is the thing.
The King and I.
Exactly. So this is The King and I came out 10 years later. But I decided to watch it because I knew that I would not enjoy The King and I because it's a musical. And this was the predecessor.
Oh, predecessor,
This is the non-musical predecessor to The King and I. And I was like, I'm not going to sit through The King and I, but I would love to know what it's about. Let me watch the Anna and the King of Siam. For those of you who are unfamiliar with either of these movies, they're about a widow who travels to Siam, which is now Thailand, but at the time was called Siam, to tutor the children of the King of Siam. The movie is fictional, or both movies are fictional, but they're based on the real memoirs of a woman who did serve as an English tutor for the 39 wives and 82 children of the King of Siam.
39 wives?
And concubines.
Wow.
And 82 children from...
Oh my God.
Yeah, from 1862 to 1868. Speaking of problematic portrayals in film, the King of Siam is played by Rex Harrison, who is a white man in yellow face.
Oh!
The same thing with Yul Brynner playing the King of Siam in The King and I. Yul Brynner is also a white man playing the Thai king in yellow face. Yellow face was a huge practice in Hollywood up until fairly recently. And while obviously horrifying today, it was
and
just
by
the way
yellow
it was.
Face, you mean?
Asian. I know it
so
sounds.
They're putting like makeup on their eyes?
I don't know if they're necessarily wearing makeup, but they're probably wearing something to pull their eyes back.
No!
Yeah.
Oh.
It's horrifying.
That is fucked up.
Yeah.
I thought they were maybe just wearing like those satin Asian clothing.
Well, that would
not
also
cool.
be. Even saying yellow face sounds offensive to me, but that's what it's called.
Because it is offensive. That's why it sounds offensive.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this was a huge practice. Mary Pickford played an Asian woman in Madame Butterfly. Catherine Hepburn played an Asian woman in Dragon Seed. All of the lead roles in The Good Earth were played by white people.
Oh my God. I love that book. They were all played by white people. I didn't know there was a movie.
Yeah.
Wow.
All the leads.
Oh.
So they would frequently have, if there were a lot of Asian characters, they would have Asian people were able to play like the bit parts, but the leads were always played by white people. Perhaps most famously, because it's the most offensive, is Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. If anyone has seen Breakfast at Tiffany's, Audrey Hepburn's character has an Asian neighbor who lives above her, and Mickey Rooney plays perhaps one of the most offensive portrayals of Asian stereotypes on film.
I don't know if I've ever seen that film.
It's sad because it is kind of a cute movie, but it ruins it. It's so hard to watch today.
Because he did like the accent and like he's pretending.
It's so exaggerated.
Because what year was the movie out?
I would say probably in the 60s too.
Okay.
Yeah. That doesn't have anything to do with the scandal, but I just wanted to sort of address the fact that while I do love movies from the 40s, I am not afraid of acknowledging the fact that we have moved so far from those portrayals. And just
because there's Twitter now.
Yeah.
And Twitter will come for that ass.
Yeah. Well, we are still casting cisgendered people as trans, you know.
Very true. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
But we'll get there, hopefully. Anyways, so there's a moment in the movie where Anna is talking to the king of Siam about one of his slaves, because they did own slaves in Siam. The slavery system was really different there, though. It wasn't race-based at all. It was just other Siamese people. It was more like a class thing, and a lot of times the slavery was a temporary situation, almost more like indentured servitude. They could pay their way out of it. Or like their family members could buy them out of it. There was a lot of ways out. Anyways, there's a slave, a female slave, whose husband wants to buy them back out of slavery. And the king doesn't want to let her go because the king really likes her. The king says no, but it is the law in Siam that they have to be allowed to purchase themselves out of slavery. And he's basically like, well, I'm the king, so I don't have to do that shit. And Anna is like, no, you're not above the law. He's like, well, isn't Queen Victoria above the law? And Anna's like, no.
No.
No, it's the law.
Yeah.
And then she's like, and while we're at it, like, President Lincoln is not above the law either. And so then the conversation sort of shifts to the subject of slavery in America and the Civil War, the movement to free the slaves in the Civil War. And the king, like, out of nowhere, sort of, like, suddenly decides he's going to dictate a letter and make her write it down. And then he's going to send President Lincoln this letter offering him a herd of elephants so that he can breed elephants in the United States and use them as, like, beasts of burden for the war effort, for the Civil War. And I'm like, okay. I'm like, this is super fucking weird, because I know that this movie is fiction, but it's also, it is based on a true story. It's based on a real woman's.
And that would be a king-like thing to do.
Yeah.
Because I think that the Sultan of somewhere gave, like, Bengal tigers. It wouldn't be the first instance of some foreign leader sending exotic things to the U.S.
Yeah. But I was just like, this is so weird. This is clearly bullshit, but I'm going to Google it just to see. And it turns out that it's real.
Yeah.
Sort of. The way that it went down in the movie is total bullshit, but the king of Siam actually had offered to send a herd of elephants to the United States in the 1860s. In the mid-1800s, most Asian countries were largely isolationist, but there was a lot of pressure on them to open themselves up to trade with the West. Europe was basically forcing themselves on Asia.
Oh, yeah.
Asia wanted and had nothing to do with it. Yeah. But
they're like, Marco Polo who?
Yeah. But Europe was like, no, you got some stuff and we want that stuff. So
gimme.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, before long, America followed suit. King, I have to say this name. I'm just going to say that the way I am pronouncing it is probably wrong, and I am aware of that, but I don't know how to pronounce Thai names properly, so I'm sorry.
You're fired.
King Mongkut took the Siamese throne in 1851, and by the following year, there was an influx of Westerners because the king wanted to bring in English and American missionaries to help teach the royal court about Western customs and the English language. In the movies, he's painted as a stubborn, sort of bumbling buffoon who's really resistant to change, but Mongkut was actually really into the idea of modernizing Siam and welcoming Western culture and technology. The Siamese nicknamed him the father of science and technology. He wasn't, however, just trying to Westernize because he thought like Burger King and Walmart were awesome and he just wanted Western culture. He was doing it because Britain and France had been advancing on territories surrounding Siam, and he thought that learning English and absorbing Western technologies and science would be a way for the Siamese to defend themselves from colonialization. basically much like what you were talking about earlier. It's sort of like get with the times, sink or swim kind of thing. Yeah,
it's like this is coming. We are powerless unless we adapt
exactly
to the climate.
So they opened themselves up to trade with Europe, and America followed suit. Japan was seen as the more valuable sort of asset in Asia, but they were super isolationist.
Oh, yeah. Japan is not having any of this. Yeah. Yeah.
But they kind of had more stuff that we wanted than Siam did. So that was our focus, was Japan.
Okay.
But Siam did actually become the first Asian nation that entered into a treaty with the U.S., like a trade agreement and treaty. In 1856, the U.S. sent Townsend Harris off to Japan to open a consulate and try and force a trade agreement. But along the way, he stopped in Bangkok and met with King Mongkut. Since the king was into the idea of accepting Western culture and moving along.
Yeah, he was open to foreigners.
So it didn't take long for Harris to get Siam to sign this treaty. And he was off on his merry way to basically force himself on Japan. And it took another 2 years before Japan signed an agreement with us. So then in 1859, President James Buchanan sent King Mongkut a letter with a generous gift to cement the relationship between the two nations. When I first read about this, I was like, that's your gift? This is so boring. Like, I would be like, go fuck yourself. But knowing how he was so interested in Western culture and he loved to read and all this stuff, it's like, okay, actually. They sent 192 books and government publications. I was like, yawn.
I mean, that sounds boring, but also I could see that being a gift.
Yeah.
It's just like, this is what we do here. Yeah. And like, you're welcome.
Yeah, totally. No, and he was really into it. The king loved it.
Yeah.
And when I first read...
He throws in some Levi's.
A Big Mac. To show his appreciation for these books, Mongkut sent a Japanese-style sword with an elaborate gold sheath.
A katana.
A portrait of himself with his family, and a huge pair of elephant tusks as a present for the American president. You know, Buchanan had sent him the books, but it took a year for them to reach Siam, and it was an election year by the time they got there. Mongkut knew that there was an election, and that by the time his gifts got back to the United States, Buchanan might no longer be the president.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
So when he sent his gifts back to the U.S., he addressed his letter to James Buchanan, but made it clear that he understood that Buchanan might not be the president.
Yeah.
In the movie, he is sending these elephants directly to Lincoln, but this is not how it happened in real life. The letter that he wrote to Buchanan and the gifts that he was sending were given to Captain Berrien of the USS John Adams, which was sent to Bangkok as a courtesy from the U.S. government. Before the ship left, the king spoke with the captain about the gifts he'd be sending, including the elephant tusks, and learned from the captain that the U.S. didn't have any native elephants. And the king was just like, really? Like, that's crazy. Elephants are awesome. You know what I mean? Because elephants are revered in Thailand.
And they're everywhere.
Yeah. And so the captain was like, these elephant tusks are fucking crazy and people are going to lose their shit because they're huge and they're awesome. And like, elephants are non-existent in the U.S. So the king was like, ran back to the palace and was like, wrote off a second letter to send with Berrien along with the gifts back to the U.S. to give to Buchanan or whoever the president would be.
Yeah.
In the letter, he says, during the interview, in reply from Captain Berrien to our inquiries of various particulars relating to America, he stated that on that continent, there are no elephants. Elephants are regarded as the most remarkable of the large quadrupeds, so that if anyone has an elephant's tusk of large size and will deposit it in any public space, people come by the thousands crowding to see it. Having heard this, it occurred to us that if, on the continent of America, there should be several pairs of young male and female elephants turned loose in forests where there was an abundance of water and grass in any region under the sun's declinations both north and south, called by the English the torrid zone, and all were forbidden to molest them, to attempt to raise them would be well, and if the climate there should prove favorable to elephants, we are of the opinion that after a while they will increase till there be large herds as there are on the continent of Asia, until the inhabitants of America will be able to catch them and tame and use them as beasts of burden, making them benefit to the country. He went on to talk about how great elephants are.
They are great.
He loved elephants. But he was like talking about how they could be used to build roads and they could do all this stuff.
Oh, okay.
Not just like elephants are super cool, but like elephants are super useful.
Okay. They're smart and they're like matrilineal.
Yeah.
And they
have It's like you can use them however you want.
Okay.
Then he went on to explain that Siam did not have the coin to send all these elephants back to the U.S. So he was like, maybe you could help me help you.
Oh.
Yeah. In his letter, he asks if the president and Congress would send a big-ass ship filled with hay and food and water over to Siam.
This sounds like a Nigerian scam. And I'm here for it.
He sent him an email. Yes.
He sent it to his grandmother.
Yeah. So he's like, send this big ass ship over and pick these elephants up and you can take them back. We'll herd up all these elephants, get them ready for you, but you have to take them. And he was also very specific in his letter about how the elephants needed enough space and that the ship would have to be really big. They would need room with stalls so that the elephants could stand up and lay down and move around. And that they would have to have, like, food and water and all this stuff. When the letter came back to the U.S., the American people were fascinated. And the letter was published in newspapers all over the country.
Wow.
But obviously, we don't have elephants running around in the wild. Buchanan had not won a second term. By the time the gifts and the letter got back to the U.S., Abraham Lincoln was president. And he had to write back and be like, hi, it's me, Abe. I'm the president now, but thanks for the cool sword and shit.
Yeah, thanks for the tusks.
Yeah, so William Seward, who oddly enough has come up many times in this podcast.
Like every episode. Yeah,
it's so weird.
Tangentially.
So William Seward was Lincoln's Secretary of State, and he handled most foreign affairs during the Lincoln administration. So Seward was the one who penned the response back to the king. But a lot of people speculate that Lincoln had either dictated it to Seward or had like had Seward write out a draft and then Lincoln like polished it before sending it because the language and tone of the letter were super Lincoln-y, according to like Lincoln scholars. His signature was warm yet plain and succinct language, even though the king's letter was super flowery. I mean, I only read a small part and it was a tongue twister just to read that. But the whole letter, like, he talks about the phases of the moon.
Oh.
Like, I'm sending you this during this moon cycle and like, this zodiac calendar and all this stuff.
Wow.
And he's, like, going totally super flowery and over the top and talking about the importance of the power of the presidency and blah, blah, blah. But then when Lincoln writes back, he's just like, hey, thanks.
Thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah, thanks, dude. He says, great and good friend. I have received Your Majesty's two letters of the date of February 14th, 1861. I have also received in good condition the royal gifts which accompanied those letters, namely a sword of costly materials and exquisite workmanship, a photographic likeness of Your Majesty and Your Majesty's beloved daughter, and also two elephant tusks of length and magnitude such as indicate that they could have belonged only to an animal which was a native of Siam.
Hilarious.
And some people, I read, like, some Lincoln scholars thought that that was kind of like a joke that he wrote that.
Yeah, it's hilarious, yeah. I think.
Your Majesty's letters show an understanding that our laws forbid the president from receiving these rich presents as personal treasures. They are therefore accepted in accordance with Your Majesty's desire as tokens of your goodwill and friendship for the American people. Congress being now in session at the Capitol, I have had a great pleasure in making known to them this manifestation of Your Majesty's munificence and kind consideration. Under their direction, the gifts will be placed among the archives in the government, where they will remain perpetually as tokens. Yeah, the language, so even this is supposed to be like plain language.
It's flowery.
But this is Lincoln's like plain language in the 1860s.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Where they will remain perpetually as tokens of mutual esteem and pacific dispositions more honorable to both nations than any trophies of conquest could be. I appreciate most highly Your Majesty's tender of good offices in forwarding this government a stock from which a supply of elephants might be raised on our own soil. This government would not hesitate to avail itself of so generous an offer if the object were one which could be made practically useful in the present conditions of the United States. Our political jurisdiction, however, does not reach a latitude so low as to favor the multiplication of the elephant, and steam on land as well as on water has been our best and most efficient agent of transportation in internal commerce. I shall have occasion at no distant day to transmit to Your Majesty some token of indication of the high sense which this government entertains Your Majesty's friendship. Meanwhile, wishing Your Majesty a long and happy life, for the generous and emoluous people of Siam, the highest possible prosperity, I commend both to the blessing of Almighty God. Your good friend, Abraham Lincoln. Washington, February 3rd, 1862. You know, this might sound like it's just kind of like a silly, fun story about some elephants that we could have had but never did. But it does sort of like show the way Lincoln handled foreign affairs at the time. America wasn't really a big player in foreign policy and foreign affairs at this time. And Lincoln, you know, at the beginning of Lincoln's presidency, the Civil War was beginning, and he had a lot on his plate. And so he didn't really have to do anything. He could have just been no, dude, I don't want your fucking elephants. Yeah, like, shut up.
It's not the time or the place
for
some elephants.
Yeah. And Europe was more the trading partner with Siam than America was, just because of the distance.
Yeah.
But Lincoln did take, even though, you know, he was dealing with a lot of shit in the Civil War and secession and all this stuff, he took the time and wanted to make sure that we had an ally in the Siamese.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of proves that Lincoln saw the bigger picture and cared about foreign policy, even though this was a time he didn't really have to as president. It's said that Mongkut was really bummed that we didn't accept the elephants and couldn't send them. But Lincoln really wanted to maintain his relationship with the Siamese, so he did send another gift to smooth things over. I shall have occasion at no distant day to transmit to Your Majesty some token of indication of high sense to which this government entertains Your Majesty's friendship. So in March 1863, the State Department commissioned a sculptor to produce a pair of presentation swords as a token of our appreciation and friendship with the Siamese. We continued to trade with Siam. Their big exports at the time, I think it said 90% of their exports were made up of rice, teakwood, and pewter.
Okay.
Yeah. And at that time, pewter was huge. Everyone used pewter in their homes. Pewter was like a big deal. Siam became a huge market for Western industrial goods and investment capital. And then they remained an ally for a really long time. They actually sided with us in World War I and signed the Treaty of Versailles and became a charter member of the League of Nations.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
But that's the story. I just thought it was a funny kind of like watching this movie. Like, this is clearly fucking fake.
Yeah, and I then, didn't know no, it was real at all.
Lincoln had to be like, oh, the Civil War is happening, but let me sit down and send the king these presentation swords to thank him. To thanks but no thanks.
Yeah.
For these elephants.
How do I say no without being rude?
Well, that's the whole thing. It was all about diplomacy at a time when we were not involved in international politics. So it really does show that Lincoln, like, had his head on straight and was able to sort of see forward.
See beyond our like, ragtag nation that was about to fall apart.
Yeah. My story is almost about the scandal that didn't happen.
Yeah.
That could have happened, but did not.
Man, I wish there were a bunch of elephants around.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is, like, can you imagine if like, maybe somewhere in the South, they could have had a home somewhere where there would be elephants running around in the wild?
But no.
Yeah. If you Google the story, there's a lot. But half of them were like, fucking Lincoln didn't take these elephants. We could have had these motherfucking elephants all over the place. And
we could have had elephants. I just have a stupid dog.
Yeah.
Right. What is this? Hilarious.
Well, that was our good episode. Yeah. Should we cheers again?
Cheers. Yeah. Cheers, guys.
Cheers. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And extra points for written reviews, guys.
Yes.
We would love some written reviews on Apple Podcasts. We will read
5-star reviews on air.
Mm.
So you guys get a little shout out.
Ooh, ooh.
We will read good 5-star reviews on air. And thank you. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo.